Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, July 31st, last day of the month, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Sam Houghton and Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with Jeff Spillane at the Cape Cod Times, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and we'll check in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle and Colleen Cronin at the Provincetown Independent. We'll hear from Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, our correspondent Mike Dean up at the State House in Boston, and WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Lots to get to. We're going to start off today rounding up some coronavirus news, and for that we're joined by WCAI's Sam Houghton. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, heading into the summer, there was a lot of anticipation about summer visitors, concern that the reopening of the economy would bring more cases. It's been about 3 weeks now since July 4th. What does the picture look like?
Yeah, so the Cape's had nearly 200 new cases of COVID-19 since the holiday. A good majority of those are just in the last 2 weeks. Health officials, they're calling this a trend, not a surge at this point. Also, you know, important to that, hospitalizations have remained pretty low. There were just two hospitalized on the Cape yesterday, although one resident did die. But hospitalizations have been nowhere near what we saw at the height of the pandemic in April or May.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about a number of parties on the Cape and younger people testing positive. There was a party in Chatham where we've heard that 13 people tested positive, and then one in Falmouth where 8 people who happened to be lifeguards tested positive. Do we get a sense of how many cases could ultimately come out of these parties?
Yeah, well, Chatham held a pop-up testing center to test people that may have gone to this party or come in close contact with someone that did. We know that almost 50 people signed up to get tested there. We don't know how many have tested positive yet, but we do know that only about 36 did actually show up for the testing. Then Falmouth, the town tested all beach staff, and it doesn't look like others were infected besides those 8. But outside of beach staff, it's hard to know who might be infected from this party. Also, I spoke with officials on the Vineyard and at the hospital. They're seeing the same trend of young people with the virus. They're mostly, if not all, asymptomatic, which is kind of troubling. But we haven't reported on any specific party that led to an outbreak on the Vineyard. But the hospital has reported 9 cases over the last month, and they say all of those are kids 18 to 25.
Now, on Cape Cod, there's a group of officials who have been keeping an eye on this, a kind of a roundtable of local leaders called the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force. What has been the reaction from them to this trend of young adults coming down with the virus?
Yeah, I mean, really, they're calling for personal responsibility. They had a press conference yesterday. They were saying they are frustrated and, you know, they're angry, really. A lot of restaurants in Chatham and Harwich have had to close, and Falmouth as well, because of employees that may have gotten the virus from these parties. One county official, Vera Harik, compared the sacrifices the younger generation made during World War II and what we were asking of kids today. It's kind of interesting. You know, 80 years ago, the younger generation was asked to storm Normandy, which they did. And kids today are being asked to not have parties, or at least do so responsibly, wear a mask, but some haven't done it. And health officials fear the impacts could be, you know, devastating for older generations. And I think we're kind of seeing this trend really across the country.
Well, aside from kind of chiding the younger generation, what have officials said can be done here?
Yeah, well, the county has released some public service announcements, as you heard in the news just now, that's aimed at educating kids over social media. But aside from education, it's tough. We heard from a Chatham selectman who basically said you can't stop people from having parties. You know, that's their right. Towns are limited, really, in what they can do. But what we did hear, State Senator Julian Steer, he says he's hoping to get a little more clarity from the governor. Will the state take a more vigilant approach if the trend on the Cape and the rest of the state, gets worse? But he also said that that trend doesn't seem to be from any line of industry allowed in, these state new reopening guidelines, like restaurants or barbershops say. He says the parties attest to this, that the latest trend is really about people relaxing their guard, getting complacent. It's a personal choice, really, to go to an indoor party or to gather in a large gathering and or not wear masks.
That is WCAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
The clusters of COVID-19 infections tied to parties on Cape Cod are raising concerns that the true number of local cases could be higher than people realize. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes has that story and joins us. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
So, Jeanette, tell us, what is the concern here?
Right. So, in a nutshell, the idea is that people who are staying on Cape Cod or really on the islands or anywhere in the area could contract COVID-19 here, but their test results, if they're not a full-time resident, would be reported in their home state or hometown somewhere else in Massachusetts. And the idea is that could be masking the true number of cases actually being contracted here.
So this would be specifically summer visitors here coming down with the virus. Their cases are reported to their hometowns and it's not sort of showing up in our tally. You spoke to somebody about this. Who did you speak to us and tell us what you heard?
Sure. I talked to Deirdre Arvidson, who's the public health nurse for Barnstable County. And she said that if a person gets tested here for COVID-19 and they have a permanent address elsewhere for any reason, like if they're here, some people here are here working for the summer, some people are, in a second home or even on vacation. If they put their home address elsewhere on their testing paperwork, that's where the results get reported by the lab performing the test. So, you go out, you fill out your paperwork with your address. That's where your results get reported, especially if you're positive in this case, where so that's what the concern is. So, if they test positive, she says, though, the way it should work is that your public health agent or some authority in your home community would get notified by the lab that they have a positive test in their community. And then that agent is supposed to reach out to the patient and call the patient. If they find out the patient is sort of staying for an extended period and contracted it somewhere else, like here, the case should be transferred to Massachusetts. They would then pick up the phone and make a call to Massachusetts health authorities and say, look, you have a case contracted in your area. So in the end, she thinks that this is not the whole idea of people getting COVID who live somewhere else is really not contributing to an inaccurate count here.
How about how these cases are accounted for within state data, kind of the larger picture here? Could they be being double counted? Are we there? Do we have you, Jeanette? Okay, I think we've lost Jeanette there. We were just asking her about how cases could be getting double counted within the state. And Jeanette did some reporting earlier this week, and she's right now. The picture appears to be that once a case gets transferred to Massachusetts, it's hard to know what happens to the data in a person's home state. So it's possible that cases could be getting double counted in two places. But the public health nurse we spoke to, Deirdre Arvidson, had said that she doesn't really know what's happening there. So that's kind of a bigger picture that's a little more opaque in how cases are tracked statewide that way or within states. We are going to move on. The island of Cuttyhunk faced a sweeping round of coronavirus testing after a number of people there tested positive a little more than a week ago. And we have an update from Vineyard Gazette reporter Noah Asimo. Oh my, let me offer a correction. This past week, Mr. Asimo was promoted to news editor. Well deserved. Congratulations, Noah.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciated. I'm blushing.
And tell us about this round of testing on Cuttyhunk. Maybe you better jump actually right to the results because they're pretty simple to explain.
Yes, all 96 residents who were tested for COVID on Tiny Cuttyhunk, which, just for a little bit of perspective, is literally everyone who wanted to get a test on the island. They all came back negative for the virus. And there was one test that had a test tube leak, and so that couldn't come back. But no one came back positive, which was, you know, really exciting for the selectmen on the island, who I think were really concerned after 8 people had tested positive for the virus approximately a week and a half ago. So it was really good news for them. They pretty much billed it as a turnaround. Of course, you know, not everything's done. You know, there are still concerns and issues. But in a place that small, they actually had the opportunity to test almost everyone who was there. And it's kind of cool that everything came back negative.
That is remarkable. So this was coming following on a point where one person had tested positive, and then kind of almost within a week,
right,
8 people tested positive.
Yes. It basically started with one individual, a female, who was on the island for a week and a half. She had not been showing symptoms, but then she started to show symptoms that they thought were allergies. And eventually she lost her sense of smell, and she left the island, got tested, came back positive. And then what happened was the state came and they tested 25 of her contacts, and it turned out that 8 of them, or I guess 7, came back positive. And what's interesting on Cuttyhunk is that there's no hospital. The doctors over the summer work there on a rotating once a week basis for the 10 weeks of the summer. So there's only at one point one doctor, and the island itself is only accessible via passenger ferry. So the state had to ship in tests. And when the 7 people came back positive, they did a much more sweeping, comprehensive look at the island just to sort of see if there was a larger outbreak beyond this individual's close contacts. And it turned out there wasn't, which I think was a huge relief to everyone.
I was going to say 96 people tested, 96 results negative. There must have been a huge collective sigh of relief coming off the island.
I think so.
But at the same time, officials are saying, you know, this isn't it. It's not over here.
Right, exactly. I mean, they're still basically saying, like anywhere in the state, you have to stay vigilant. Masks are now mandatory on the island. That has kind of prompted that. And it's a small, tight-knit community over there. And one thing they are mentioning is no parties. And they want to, I think really they want to make sure that just because, or people know, just because they're on Cuttyhunk, which happens to be the smallest and most remote town in the state, the virus can reach and spread there as well. And, you know, maybe that was something that was sort of a new reality for them that came earlier this month, that they previously hadn't been thinking about at all. But they did want to, you know, they did want to mention too that the town marina, it remains open. It's a popular stopping off point for fishermen. Even though mandatory mask rules are in place, they are clear, you know, the island is not closed down despite this. And they don't plan for it to close down, at least at this moment.
That is Noah Azimo, news editor from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Questions around zoning for short-term rentals have resulted in tempers flaring in Barnstable. Jeff Spillane with the Cape Cod Times joins us with that story. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Jeff, this issue has been simmering for some time. It seemed to come kind of boiling to a head on Monday at a planning board meeting. Tell us what happened here.
Yeah, it sure has. It's been going on for more than a year, Steve, as you know, more and more short-term rentals pop up with Airbnb and Vrbo. But there is a zoning amendment that's being floated in the town of Barnstable that would actually say that any lawful property, any lawful building in town could be used for short-term rentals. And right now you can do that anyway, but the town had not anticipated decades ago that we would have these online short-term rental sites. So it has been quite a contentious issue, a lot of tension between residents and town officials, but I got to tell you, this one's become particularly nasty. The planning board did vote 3-1 on Monday night to recommend this amendment be forwarded to the Barnstable Town Council, in addition to allowing the rentals in all the, as I say, the lawful dwellings. It also says that parking cannot, for all intents and purposes, happen on the front lawns of these homes. That was in there for some reason. And the council next month will also be taking up an ordinance to apply regulation to these rentals. So we're talking about licensures, procedures for reporting an incident should something happen, things along that line. So
explain why, how the tempers really, it seemed like the feeling here is so strong, and that
it's
really
it is.
Kind of,
and you know, there's a group of residents, and it started in Osterville, but it's townwide now. And to make a long story short, what they're saying is, hey, you know, we bought homes here in residential areas, and now people are buying houses sometimes right next to us, and in often cases they're out-of-region investors. So in effect, they're turning them into hotels with people coming and going, saying, and they're saying, you know, that could be dangerous. We don't know who's in there. They could only be there for a night. And as a matter of fact, we now know that a shooting did indeed occur at one of these short-term rentals in Hyannis early this year. And the opponents, who call themselves Barnstable Watch, they don't want to ban short-term rentals, but they want to keep them in areas where they've traditionally been. So we're talking about beach areas like Craigville, cottage colonies, but not everywhere in town. You know, try to you know, really have some limitations on these residential areas. And there has been a lot of, as I say, drama. Before this hearing, Steve, on Monday, a letter had gone to town officials in Barnstable claiming the chair of the planning board himself had a rental property, maybe as many as five, and was an Airbnb host. So, you know, this guy should recuse himself. His name is Steve Costello. Well, that wasn't the case. And he said, at one place, I did have a house that I briefly offered as a short-term rental, but I sold it early this year. And he didn't take well to the effort and the tactics being used to get him to recuse himself. And he really went off and chastised these opponents, saying, we're dealing with a very savvy group here. He referred to them as paid lobbyists, saying anyone who has a differing opinion is subject to a personal attack. So it got really heated, and he eventually recused himself because he has family in the real estate business and pretty much didn't want them to be dragged through the mud. And then it took another turn, Steve, and he said, I'm recusing myself so I can shine a light on the spouse of a Barnstable town councilor who's involved, and I quote here, on these vicious attacks on people. And he was referring to Heather Hunt, who's married to David Bogan, who's a town council representing Osterville. So it really went downhill pretty fast on Monday night.
So with all this contentiousness around this issue, and these people who feel like short-term rentals are businesses being operated in residential areas, tell us what happens next. Where does this go for Barnstable?
And first of all, David Bogan said, no, I'm not going to recuse myself when it comes to the town council. I don't have a legal or financial interest in any short-term rentals. It goes to the town council now where they will consider it. Obviously, they are the final say in this matter. Looks like that's going to happen on August 20th. And I should mention, too, that this comes hot on the heels of Councilor Britt Biedenbender resigning about 2 weeks ago. And among the reasons she cited for her resignation was a constant stream of insults and criticism from constituents. She referred to it as gotcha politics and cancel culture. And she's gone through several of these scrapes between residents and town officials. And, you know, it's unfortunate.
There's a sense there that the civic discourse right now is at a particularly rancorous moment.
It is, and I should say that there was a public records request where some private texts between Councilor Biedenbender and her good friend Jennifer Cullum were released, and they were talking to each other, didn't think it would ever get public, and these were texts calling people, you know, there's some colorful language, calling someone a jerk and an idiot and this and that. But she referred to it as a smear campaign. The texts were sent throughout town. They were sent to civic associations, and she said, you know, people are out to get me. Whatever I'm going to say is going to be misinterpreted or twisted. And then she dropped the mic and walked away. Mm. So, yeah, it's going to be very interesting.
That is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times with the story. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. A popular Chatham beach is the subject of a preservation effort. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has this one. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, this beach seems to be sending out early warnings about sea level rise. Tell us what's happening here.
Sure. Now, we're talking about Jackknife Harbor, or Jackknife Cove, as it's sometimes called. If you're not familiar with the area, it's on Pleasant Bay. Right at the Chatham Harwich town line, where Muddy Creek runs into the bay. That's where a new bridge was built across Route 28 a couple of years ago, and it's popular for swimming and kayaking, shellfish. You don't need a permit there, so it gets a lot of activity. But the major access is a steep unpaved road that runs along the water, And in recent years, erosion has cut into the bank and a nearby marsh and the parking area, which floods pretty frequently. In fact, there's a sign there that floods at extreme high tides, and someone has crossed out extreme and written every tide, which gives you an idea of how often it floods there. But as you said, Steve, it's Pleasant Bay is kind of a hot spot for sea level rise. There's been some studies done that show some pretty drastic anticipated changes in the coming years. And the Pleasant Bay Alliance, which is a group that is sponsored by the four bay towns, that's Chatham, Harwich, Orleans, and Brewster. They recently got a coastal resiliency grant from the state to study climate change impacts on several locations in the bay to look at whether innovative shoreline protection strategies could provide some buffer to sea level rise. And apparently, from their studies, Jackknife is a perfect spot for this. According to Alliance Coordinator Carol Ridley, the goal here is to use natural features and resources like grasses and shells to try to mimic the natural function of a coastal process and protect the shoreline. Wilkinson Ecological Designs is working on a number of concepts for what they call a living shoreline approach, which here includes things like a biodegradable shell bag. That's a plant-based plastic type bag filled with oyster or mussel shells that they would pack underneath parts of the marsh that have been undercut by erosion. And there'd be sort of a natural fiber blanket on top of this, which together would sort of mimic a natural peat bed, and it would allow plants to take root, which would hold the shoreline in place against the sea level rise. It would build it up and hold it in place. And that's they hope that something like this could protect the accessway and the vehicle parking area from encroachment by the water as tidal levels increase because of climate change. They're really in the sort of reporting and designing process of this. The Alliance has applied for a second round of grants to finalize the designs and begin permitting. At this point, there's been no commitment to go forward with this from the town of Chatham, which owns the property. But the Alliance and the town are actually working very closely together to not only finalize this study, but also to identify funds from either state grants or possibly Community Preservation Act money to help implement this plan in the near future. And they're kind of hoping that in the meantime, we don't get any major storms like we did. You know, if you remember back in 2018, we had a couple, several major storms in a row that caused some significant damage along the eastern shoreline and in this location as well. And officials just sort of have their fingers crossed that that doesn't happen again before they can implement some sort of solution. And as we see, we've got a potential hurricane coming up the coast next week. So, you know, they certainly are hoping that things like that don't have a major impact on the areas they're looking to preserve. Mm.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle updating us on that. Tim Wood, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Steve.
Earlier this summer, the Provincetown Independent looked at arrest data for the Outer Cape and found that black people are arrested at disproportionately higher rates. While they're 1-3% of the population, they represent 8-12% of arrests. We're joined now by reporter Colleen Cronin to talk about a follow-up to this story. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, Steve.
Colleen, in your initial story, the local police chief suggested it was unfair to compare resident data to arrests because of the high number of tourists coming through the area. You dove a little deeper to see if that data supported that. Tell us what you found.
So I think that suggestion sort of comes in two parts. So when it comes to the summer influx, we actually found that many of the folks who were arrested were residents and many were arrested in the off season. So for example, if you looked at Truro, 7 out of the 9 arrests were residents. And if you looked at Eastham, none of the arrests occurred in the peak summer season, which you'd consider between July 4th and Labor Day, right? So it didn't seem like the summer influx specifically was a cause of the disparity. However, despite the fact that the data didn't point to that, the chiefs were right to say that the street population data doesn't make for the best comparison. I spoke to an expert at Northeastern, Jack McDevitt, who said that really when you're looking at trying to find disparities in arrest data, the best comparison you could make would be to the percentage, the population in your community who's committing crimes. And then for the stop data, if you could make the best comparison, it would be to who your driving population is. And those two different populations can be a lot different than your census data.
Now, looking at data like this is very complicated. What are some of the factors that have to be taken into account as you're trying to pull out a clear picture here?
I think besides looking at that, what you're comparing the percentages to, I think something that I found really interesting that the chiefs talked about in what we saw in the data was whether or not a call was police-initiated or citizen-initiated. So, for example, Truro had 4 domestic violent arrests, and those were all police. Those were not police-initiated. Those were someone, perhaps a neighbor or the victim calling in the crime. And that's a lot different than a police officer seeing someone driving a car and making an arrest and knowing then what the race of that person was. So I thought that was an interesting component that we didn't expect to really understand or look through, but then parsing through the data the second time was very interesting to investigate.
So one of the things you discovered is that the police don't have one way of reporting race data when it comes to traffic stops and arrests. Tell us why that's important to the story.
I think it's important for a couple of reasons. I think for us at the Independent, it made comparisons and analysis really difficult. Ryan Fitzgerald, who worked on the story for me and who was really great about pouring through the data to start, just had a lot of trouble trying to hold things the same for the different towns. So it made cross-town analysis a bit difficult. And I think it comes to the traffic stop data especially. There actually isn't a requirement for law enforcement agencies to report the race of a person who's been stopped if the stop hasn't ended in a citation or an arrest. So that really, as Jack McDevitt said, who I spoke to, who's an expert in this and has been working on this for quite a while, if you don't have that data, you won't know if there's a problem and you won't know if there's something to fix. And traffic stops are probably the most common way that people in the community are interacting with the police. So to not have data on something like that consistently across the state in every community, how are you supposed to know that there's a problem that you need to mitigate?
Reporter Colleen Cronin from the Provincetown Independent speaking with us. Colleen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
A doctor at St. Luke's Hospital in New Bedford came down with COVID-19, and it changed how we thought of the virus. Jack Spillane of the Standard Times has the story for us. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how are you, Steve?
And Jack, the doctor's name is Michael Baretti. Tell us about him.
This is just an very unnerving story. Dr. Baretti was the chief of the IC unit at St. Luke's Hospital, and they were going along in a very regimented style dealing with the COVID. And he noticed that when he went into the unit one day, he felt cold. And so he didn't think anything of it. But then he began to have symptoms. He began to have an earache. And he was tested, but the tested came back negative. But he was feeling worse and worse. And so he began to make plans to quarantine himself. And then he had another test, and he did come back positive, and he had contracted coronavirus. And so the story we have is about, you know, what that was like for him to in his family, to have to be separated. He had to live someplace else. So it was quite an unnerving story for those who have followed the tales of frontline workers.
So here he is, an ICU doctor and a relatively young person with, you know, in good physical shape. And one of the things he reports is just how surprised he was by the impact of this virus on him.
Yes, his quote was, "I've had the flu before, and this was not the flu." He had delirium and body aches and extreme fatigue. He said it was like nothing else he had ever gotten, in which when I read the story, I thought, well, that's just it. People think this is a disease of the elderly. And and to be fair, 65% of the Massachusetts cases have been elderly people or people in nursing homes. But there are people who get very, very sick and who are younger. We had another story, I think we talked to you about earlier, about a plumber from Acushnet who was relatively healthy and got very, very sick, but also beat it.
And Dr. Baretti, boy, just the personal story that he tells here about his wife came down with it then, and what happened. They had three kids, I think, and what happened with their, you know, they were both down with this, and their kids had to go stay somewhere else, and they didn't see them for several weeks. He says the whole thing gave him a new respect for this disease.
Yes, and I think this is the impact that people who haven't been through it or don't have a loved one who has been through it don't see, how it can quickly make things fall apart from a family. You know, not only do you have to isolate from each other, but then the question is, what do you do with the children? And it was really heart-wrenching, the story about his oldest daughter, who had more awareness of the seriousness of the matter than the other kids, and how she cried when they finally got back, because she had sort of been acting as a little surrogate mother while her parents were isolated. It really is just a hot touching story, and it does show that the impacts can be just quite extensive.
And you have some great photographs to go with that in the New Bedford Standard Times. You can see them on South Coast Today. Jack Spillane, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. In West Tisbury, a favorite hen met an early demise in the jaws of a dog, and it's prompted some human drama. George Brennan brings us the story from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hi, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
George, I think I've given you plenty of setup for this one. Why don't you jump in and tell us what happened here?
Yeah, so this happened at the home of Cynthia Riggs, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar with Cynthia. She's a mystery writer. But in this case, there wasn't much of a mystery to what happened to her beloved hen, Buffy. There was a dog from a neighbor's yard that came in and was caught in the act of this by one of the people who rents from Cynthia on the property. That's Lynn Christopher's. She actually is a contributor to the Times periodically. And one of those instances where, you know, a dog's instincts came into play here. The dog was on the loose, unleashed, and saw this chicken and went after it. And this isn't the first time that this has happened on her property. Last year, 13 of her birds were killed by an unidentified assailant, as Rich Salzberg puts it in his story. So this all came before the Board of Selectmen in West Tisbury. The dog's owner, this is Matt Hayden, had to go before the board, and he pretty much admitted that it was his dog that did this. The board eventually voted to declare this dog a nuisance and told Mr. Hayden that he would have to fence in his yard. When they told him that, that's when things took an interesting turn. He said that he would euthanize the dog himself and that they could come and watch it.
Rather than fencing right. the yard, he just said, well, then if I have to do that, I'm just going to euthanize the dog.
Absolutely. He said he was going to take matters into his own hands. He didn't explain how he was going to do that, but that upset the board. That's not what they were looking for. They do have it in their authority to say that a dog has to be put down, but they did not. And many of our commenters also were upset by this. Some, you know, saying, look, put this dog in foster care and, you know, rehome the dog. It turns out we did do a follow-up, and the dog was not harmed. And Mr. Hayden has agreed to work on putting up a fence in his yard and keeping his dog on a leash. So for the time being, the dog is safe, and but people are really keeping an eye on this, disturbed by, you know, some of the comments made publicly by Mr. Hayden that, you know, he wanted to put the dog down and put the dog down himself. Hmm.
George, also this week, a mishap in Menemsha did not fortunately injure anyone, but it did make for a pretty spectacular photo essay. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so this seems to happen once a year on the island. Unfamiliar people on the island take a wrong turn. And in this case, the driver of a Range Rover was looking to make a three-point turn on a dock. And when he did, apparently these Range Rovers have some specialized way of putting the car into drive or reverse. And he thought it was in reverse. It was in drive, and he went crashing through the railing. According to eyewitness accounts, the vehicle, when it hit the water, catapulted and went on its back and rested in the channel. And three people were inside, all miraculously got out. None of them really seriously hurt, just shaken up. And yeah, this happened right about sunset in Menemsha, which is a really, really busy time there. Mm-hmm. Because it's a beautiful spot to see the sunset, and we've had some spectacular ones recently. And so there were a lot of people there who witnessed it, and we talked to quite a few of them. And lots of people, one person jumped into the water to see if they could help, and a person on a boat motored over there, and one of the passengers was able to grab onto the boat, and he pulled her over to the dock. Another one was able to climb up on the back of that boat using the ladder. So a very, very dramatic scene. And then the next morning, they brought in an excavator to pull out the Land Rover. And that makes for quite a dramatic picture and video on our website as well.
It's not often you do get to see what looks like a fairly new car just being lifted out of the water and set on the side again.
Yeah, it is an amazing sight to see that. And, you know, we're just happy that everybody, you know, got out of this really dramatic crash without any injury. I guess it speaks volumes about the safety of the Land Rover. It doesn't even look bad. You know, when you look at it in the photos, it looks like it could be driven off.
Yeah, when they set it back on the dock, it looks like it's ready to drive away, as you say. Yeah, George.
Absolutely.
Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. Lawmakers were busy this week as they worked toward today's deadline, the end of the formal session. But with the coronavirus pandemic and calls for police reform, House lawmakers voted to extend the session through the end of the year. WCAI's Catherine Ident talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about this unusual move and other items lawmakers tackled this week.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Well, it was a busy week with a lot to cover, but first, I want to talk about this extension to the session. House leadership passed an order on Wednesday allowing lawmakers in that chamber to continue in formal sessions beyond today's deadline.
Yeah, so this is them kind of admitting that they're not going to get their work done. It seemed kind of clear for a while that this July 31st deadline was not going to be met for a good chunk of the work that they've kind of said that they're going to get done. And a lot of that is, of course, because of the pandemic. It's turned the state budget upside down, and it's really turned this lawmaking session upside down. And they've really had to rethink how they approach things like this. So not only will an extended session allow the legislature to react to the pandemic, potentially pass more laws, you know, on an emergency basis as they need throughout the rest of the year, it also gives them a lot more time to reach compromise on the things that they've said that they're going to pass by the end of the session. There are, you know, at least a dozen other, you know, big ticket items that have been, you know, left till the last minute that now the last minute has been pushed back, essentially. It's how they roll in the House, a little bit more so than in the Senate. But, you know, when you leave everything to the last week, it quickly becomes apparent that you're not going to get it all done. And in a situation like this, it actually is extremely important to get at least most of it done. So they're going to buy themselves some more time to do so. The drawback of that is that when they recess in August, most of the time, they go back to district work and they prepare for their own re-elections. So we have a scenario now where some of these representatives who might have primary challenges on September 1st are now potentially voting on major pieces of legislation with an opponent breathing down their necks. So it could really politicize some of these votes. And if there's any kind of emergency legislation that needs to be taken up after Election Day, when you have potentially lame duck lawmakers, it really opens up a whole political can of worms that this recess is there to prevent. So doing away with that does have some drawbacks.
What about the idea of momentum? You know, there's something to be said for the energy that lawmakers need to put into things as the deadline approaches. It kind of reminds me of cramming for finals. But with things like the police reform bill, which is a very thorny and sweeping piece of legislation that they're trying to iron out, is there any danger that something like that will stall out?
This is the one caveat that Senate President Karen Spilka put in her statement about extending the session. She said that the Senate will essentially agree to what the House is doing. However, Spilka said the police reform bill that is in conference right now, you know, but in that six-member conference committee negotiations between the House and the Senate, the police reform bill should still get done by Friday night, the original deadline. She says it's too important to extend that one out. So that puts a lot of pressure on those six members to get their work done. We don't have a commitment from the House that they also intend to get it done by Friday night. Of course, you're right. That's where a lot of urgency is. People talk about how, you know, the protesters really put this on the legislative agenda all of a sudden in the middle of a pandemic. It was not expected. You know, this was not something people were looking at the beginning of the session. So this is something that the Overton window, as we say, might be closing on police reform. So the Senate wants to get that done ASAP. Keep a lookout as to when those negotiations wrap up.
I want to look now at some of the work that was getting done this week. There was a lot happening in the House, for instance, tackling this huge omnibus economic development bill that has a lot of pieces to it.
You know, when you leave things to the deadline, a lot of these bills kind of get glommed together into these big omnibus pieces in the House. That was certainly the case this week where this economic development bill came out. It would boost jobs. It has a lot of kind of protections for jobs during the pandemic, things like that. But it also goes further to do some major changes to housing policy. So it includes Governor Baker's language that he prefers that would make it easier for cities and towns to approve housing construction, basically lowering the threshold from two-thirds support on a select board or in whatever town legislative committee there is down to majority support. This would grant a lot more access to housing development. This is something that progressives had not been so sure about for a while, but it did pass in the House. It passed in the Senate as well. So that's one area where they're on the same page. The House and Senate, however, are not on the same page on another big change in that economic development bill, which is allowing sports betting. The House is gung-ho for it. They included a legal of sports betting in their bill that would allow it at racetracks, casinos, and online. And the Senate did not. The Senate said that now is not the time to consider something like this. But, you know, again, a lot of work to do, and that's part of the reason why they tried to buy themselves more time with that extension.
Lawmakers have also been tackling health care with a debate over a period of several days.
Yeah, healthcare is all over the place. This is one thing where if anyone's going to be the most skeptical about them getting anything done this year, it's on the healthcare front. There are certain items related to the pandemic that it seems like they are on the same page and in agreement on when it comes to like expanding telehealth services and kind of regulating telehealth for the first time. Obviously, that's been a huge part of caretaking during the pandemic. But the Senate passed a package of bills over the course of the last year. They have things on pharmaceutical pricing, on behavioral health care, all sorts of kind of very broad-based, you know, future-minded and cost-saving plans for the healthcare sector. The House didn't really pass anything until this last week. They put up a healthcare bill that kind of came out of, I won't call it nowhere because we were expecting something, but we didn't know what was going to be in it. It resembles the bill that failed to pass 2 years ago that has a lot more to do with community hospitals than it does with the stuff that the Senate's been talking about. So they have many, many different balls in the air. The two chambers don't have a lot of overlap at all, except for some of the pandemic language. So going into a conference committee on that, with these six members have to negotiate a resolution to get something passed, is going to be a big question mark.
And finally, I would be remiss if I did not mention the budget, because we are well into fiscal year 2021. We do not have a budget for this year. There are a lot of reasons as to why, but instead of doing a one-month interim budget, lawmakers decided to do a three-month budget.
Instead of doing these one-month incremental budgets that they had been doing to keep government afloat in this new fiscal year, they're going to set one up that's going to pay the bills through October 1st, meaning that they really don't have to come back until September. And when they do, hopefully they'll have a much better idea of what the state's finances look like, if Congress is going to act to bail out states or municipalities or even more aid to small businesses, things like that. That's a huge question mark and a huge X factor in the math that they're doing at the state level. We don't know if Governor Baker is going to accept a three-month plan. He's been offering these one-month-as-you-go type budget and spending plans. Doing it in a three-month chunk might not be what the governor had in mind, so we're going to have to see if he approves that as well.
And that is WCAI Statehouse reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks for keeping an eye on everything on Beacon Hill. Have a great weekend.
Great to be with you, Catherine.
And that's WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean at the Statehouse. We're going to close today with an upbeat story, and for that we bring on WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, nearly half of Cuttyhunk Island will be protected against future development and preserved forever as publicly accessible conservation land. Tell us what's happened this week with this.
Yeah, so basically the Buzzards Bay Coalition and its partners have bought up about half of the island, all of the undeveloped land left, about half its total acreage. What they're buying includes coastal marsh, upland habitats, barrier beaches like Barges Beach that represent 5 miles of the Massachusetts coastline. And they've bought them for the public to enjoy and to access really in perpetuity.
And was there a moment that they decided they had to do this right now?
Yeah, they were looking at the fact that there was a real threat of development. This land was on the market. It was eyed by, luxury home developers, maybe some commercial developers. And these environmentalists said, we need to protect the single groundwater drinking source. We also need to be mindful of climate change and resiliency. And the more land you have for, coastal marshes to be resilient, to retreat into, to adapt, the better for the whole island and its future resilience.
A nice story there. WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for jumping on at the end of the show here.
Thank you, Steve.
That is our show for today, a jam-packed show. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from WCAI's Sam Houghton and Jeanette Barnes, Jeff Spillane at the Cape Cod Times. We spoke with Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Colleen Cronin at the Provincetown Independent and Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we heard from Mike Dean up at the State House and WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio for doing that thing that he does to make this program magically appear for you. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.